you know, because we want to try to be objective, yes, you know, and be evidence-based. All that is true, but there has to be deference to the bedside clinician. And that's what the two-midnight rule really, really is that there's deference to what the clinician is saying.
Hello and welcome to the Better Care Podcast, where we tell the stories of clinicians, healthcare leaders, and innovators who are improving the way clinicians work and deliver care. We've got a great deep dive of an episode today, as Evidence Care's VP of Clinical Strategy, Carol Howard, recently hosted a live panel of experts on regulatory updates related to Medicare Advantage plans and guidelines like the Tube Midnight Rule. Our esteemed guests included Jackie Kimmel of the Health Management Academy, Dr. Adam Fall of Erlanger Health, and Dr. Jenny McNair from Physicians Advisory, MedMetrics, who gave listeners strategic insights on training approaches, documentation practices, and contract negotiation tips to equip hospitals to succeed in this evolving landscape. And to those listening on audio only, I did want to mention that Jackie Kimmel kicked off the live event with a short presentation, so you'll hear her call out a few items on her slides. You should still be able to follow along, but if you're interested in seeing the slides as well, the video version of this episode is always available at evidence.care/bettercarepodcast. Thanks for listening and enjoy the episode.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a special live episode of the Better Care Podcast. I'm Carol Howard, the VP of Clinical Strategy at Evidence Care, and I'm really excited to be hosting today as we dive into the topic of navigating Medicare two-midnight Medicare Advantage and payer rules. I have assembled a great panel of experts to help me cover this topic, so let me introduce them. Jackie Kimmel is the Senior Director of Strategy Catalyst for the Health Management Academy. She has done a lot of fantastic research into Medicare Advantage policy changes that impact hospitals and payers. So she's going to kick us off with a brief presentation to help set the stage for today's panel. Then we have Dr. Adam Fall, who is Corporate Medical Director of Utilization Management at Erlanger, which is a sixth hospital system here in Tennessee. He's also a Senior Fellow of Hospital Medicine, Board Certified Physician Advisor. He is on the advisory board for the Epic Care Management and also just received his master's in healthcare delivery science. And congratulations again, Dr. Fall. Last but not least is Dr. Jenny McNair, who is president and chief physician advisor at Physician Advisory Services of MedMetrics, a division of MedMetrics. Past roles have included national medical directorships in UMUR in case management, head of clinical transformation and population health management. She attended the University of Texas Health Sciences Center at San Antonio, followed by a residency at Wake Forest University Baptist Medical Center in North Carolina. And she lives in Texas with her husband, two kiddos, two spoiled lab dogs, which I love labs, and has various foster puppies, three very snobby cats, and ask her sometime about life on a sailboat. Everyone will have great perspectives and experience on this topic, and I'm excited for you to hear from them. For those of you who have joined us live today, on the right side of your screen, there is a Q&A tab next to the chat box. So feel free to submit your questions as we go, and we'll have some time at the end to answer as many as we can. So before we jump into the panel discussion, Jackie, I'm going to hand it over to you to kick us off with some of your research.
Thanks so much, Carol, and thanks everyone for joining us today. As Carol mentioned, my name is Jackie Kimmel. I'm a senior director working closely with strategy leaders from hospitals and health systems around the country. And this has been a very hot topic, as you can imagine, amongst strategy leaders, but also kind of across the C-suite for the last year in particular. I've given a similar presentation to CEOs, CFOs, CMOs, many other leaders across the health system, just trying to understand the moment that we are in with Medicare Advantage today. So what I'm hoping to do is just briefly set the stage and then turn it over to our esteemed panelists to really dive much more into the Medicare two-midnight rule and the inclusion in Medicare Advantage. So, you know, I think many of us all know that Medicare Advantage has grown so rapidly over the course of the last few years in particular, to the point that MA now covers 54% of all Medicare beneficiaries. And the question that folks always have is, how much more is this going to continue to grow? So we're in an interesting moment right now, because next year will be the peak of the baby boomers. So there are 4.2 million baby boomers that will turn 65 in 2025. And that is actually the peak demographic shift, I believe, ever in terms of the most number of people aging into Medicare. So it breaks down about 11,000 patients per day aging into Medicare. Now, the majority of those patients are picking Medicare Advantage. And, you know, as those choices play out over time, the Congressional Budget Office is now predicting that by 2030, about 62% of all Medicare beneficiaries around the country will be on Medicare Advantage versus just 38% that will be in Medicare fee-for-service. So that is a huge change coming up. But many others predict that the growth is kind of going to slow down and that things are going to start to shift because of a lot of the headwinds that payers are starting to see in the program. And part of that really goes back to the demographic challenge that you can see shown on the left here, which is that the oldest baby boomers have been in Medicare for 12 years now. And this is very much leading to a different type of utilization pattern and challenge than we've seen in the past when it comes to kind of predicting the medical expenses and utilization of those in the program. It's also very much the case that because of this rapid growth in Medicare Advantage, CMS is getting really concerned about how to pay for this program moving forward. Medicare Advantage costs 5% of the entire federal budget. That is not just the healthcare budget, that is the entire federal budget. And it's equivalent, the spending on Medicare Advantage that the government spends is equivalent to 1.5% plus of all GDP. It's actually larger than the GDP of many countries in the world. And so I think CMS has really been trying over the course of the last few years to rein in the program with a number of policy changes to try and spend less on Medicare Advantage. And so you can see a number of these changes here. I'm sure many of you will be familiar with these. The number one I would call out is the version 28 HCC model. And so many will know V28 well. The changes with V28 really are trying to limit the types of codes that are most commonly upcoded within Medicare Advantage or potentially overcoded, and very much trying to rein in spending as a result. Because of version 28, which is phased in over time, many of our health systems that have at-risk contracts are expecting headwinds in revenue of up to 20% over the course of the next few years, some with headwinds in revenue even getting up to 30% over the course of the next few years. So that is a huge policy change that is limiting the profitability for Medicare Advantage for the large payers. And then you can see here a number of other changes to star ratings, RADV audits, the 2025 final rule and the final rate announcement, as well as the prior auth final rule, which didn't change a whole ton, but all kind of chipping away at the average profit margins that large MA payers are getting. But it's not just regulations. There's a lot of other headwinds that major payers are starting to see now. They're starting to see more outpatient procedures. They're starting to see a higher proportion of agents. And when they have agents, there tends to be a lot of spending that happens really quickly. There's also been challenges with forecasting, with simple things like expecting how bad the flu season is going to be have been much more challenging over the course of the last few years. And there's been a lot of challenges for these large payers to try and use things that they want to use, like AI, to try and estimate and predict who will need things like post-acute care, where they have faced class action lawsuits for trying to deny care using AI. So all of this together, you start to see a pretty dire financial situation for many of these payers, especially those like Humana that have really relied on Medicare Advantage over the course of the last few years, seeing a huge hit to their share prices, their overall income, and of course, their medical loss ratio being much higher than they would hope it to be. And so as you look back historically, you see, of course, that Medicare Advantage was easily the most profitable business line that many of these payers have. As you can see in that pink bar there on the left, they were making gross margins of just about $2,000 per patient per year. So you can imagine when they have millions of patients signed up, how much they were making on Medicare Advantage, to the case where, you know, a payer like United has 15% of their total medical membership be in Medicare Advantage, but it's 50% almost of their entire revenue. But that is starting to change. While many of them were seeing average margins of about 5% in 2019, that dropped to 3.4% in 2022. And many of them are now hoping to break even in 2024, with some actually being in the red for this year. And this is going to get worse because of all of the headwinds that we just talked about. So McKinsey is now predicting $80 PMPM headwinds through 2025 for those major payers in Medicare Advantage due to all of the challenges that we just talked about. Based on all of these margins tightening, all of these challenges and headwinds for payers, they are starting to treat health systems very differently and providers very differently around Medicare Advantage patients in particular. And so you're starting to see a case where they are pricing a lot of friction into plans and into how they are able to offer, you know, these pretty rich supplemental benefits in the market. They are doing that by pricing in a lot of friction around denials, around prior auths, around all of these points of friction that are starting to really lead to challenges for health systems around the country. And so you'd see these statistics here, like one from R1, showing that MA denials grew 147% in 2024 compared to even 2023, when they were already elevated compared to previous historical levels. And so as a result of that, we are really arguing that health systems around the country are needing to adopt a more active Medicare Advantage strategy. And this is kind of our game board of strategic responses. We're seeing many health systems, you know, a couple of them trying to maintain the status quo, trying to renegotiate contracts, but many of them taking option number two here, where they're exiting some or all MA contracts, trying to select preferred plan partners, trying to really work with payers to streamline the prior auth claim denial process, or trying to take on risk themselves to cut payers out of this equation entirely. Because ultimately, what many are seeing is, you know, it's just not going to be possible to have MA continue the way it has been, and to have denials, prior auth, all of these challenges continue into the future from a financial perspective. So that's just a little bit of background. I could go on for many more hours around the current state of MA, but just wanted to set the stage with kind of what we're seeing around the country. Any questions from you, Carol, or from anyone on the line?
Thank you, Jackie. That is so informative. And I think it's important for everyone to understand what the Medicare Advantage plans are seeing. So they had major profits from the Medicare Advantage plans per member. And CMS is implementing a few different things that's going to decrease their revenue. An important thing to call out are the HCC codes, is that's how the MA plans are paid for the members, looking at their risk. The star ratings, they received $12.8 billion more dollars in 2023 than previous years. And that's what those MA plans use to offer additional benefits to their covered lives, like dental or vision or whatever. But also the medical loss ratio, which is the money spent on each member, has gone from 85.5%. It's now creeped up to 88.9%, which these different Medicare Advantage plans don't like. So they're coming after the hospitals, I think, to make up that money for sure. So,
yep, I think so. And I think it's going to continue with all those headwinds I was talking about that McKinsey is predicting. It's just going to get worse in 2025 as exactly as you say, they price in that friction with providers, hoping that you know, if they deny claims enough times that they're not going to be resubmitted and that they can avoid that care happening and avoid that medical loss ratio being higher than they want it to be.
Right. I'm going to go on and start talking to Dr. Fall and Dr. McNair, and as well as Jackie providing some comments. So just to start us off, I know everyone knows what the CMS two midnight rule is, but can you explain, Dr. Fall, a little bit of the significance in hospital utilization management related to CMS two midnight rule?
Sure. So the two midnight rule has been around since 2013. It's hard to believe that we're, you know, almost 12 years in. And I do want to point out that there are three components to the two midnight rule. Sometimes we get lost in that first part, which is the 2 minute expectation. So there's the 2 minute expectation, which is that generally a claim is payable by part A if the admitting physician at the time of admission thinks the patient is going to require medically necessary hospital care that will is expected to pass 2 midnights. They don't have to pass 2 midnights, and we can perhaps get into the nuances of that, but it's just the expectation that they will pass 2 midnights. The second component is the inpatient only list. There are certain CPT codes that translate into ICD PCS codes that CMS says, because of the intensity of the procedure or the amount of resources required to take care of that patient, regardless of the length of stay, those claims should be Part A reimbursable. And then the final one is the case-by-case exception, which is if the admitting physician feels that this patient's probably not going to stay 2 midnights, but because of the complexity of their issues, the intensity of services, a good example may be a DKA patient that's going to require maybe some ICU care, insulin drips, a lot of frequent checking of labs, but sometimes recover very quickly. But those still should be inpatient. And there's some unforeseen circumstances and other things that we could talk about, the nuances that would truncate that stay that was unforeseen. You know, patient has to transfer, they leave AMA, et cetera. I think the significance, obviously, in UM is that it affects whether you're going to have a DRG reimbursement or an APC OBS outpatient reimbursement. And as we know, that those DRGs, for the most part, are reimbursed at a higher level. So the revenue associated with that is going to be better for the hospitals for DRGs. The other thing is like value-based purchasing that has, you know, the readmission penalties and other things are only associated with inpatients. So if a patient is admitted as an observation, they don't count towards the value-based purchasing or the star ratings. And then, of course, there's the audit risks associated with these short stays, meaning they're less than 2 midnights. So if a patient comes in, there's an inpatient order, the hospital drops a claim for a patient that did not stay 2 midnights past that inpatient order, there's at least some potential risk associated with that from a compliance standpoint. And CMS has a lot of mechanisms to look into that. The MACs, the RACs, the Target Probe and Educate, and even you can use the PEPR to see if you are you're an outlier, the use of the 2 midnight rule.
Thank you, Dr. Fall. A couple things there. I find it interesting that originally the 2 midnight rule was brought into existence because the OIG did an audit on inpatients that were too short and they were paying for those inpatient stays. So the PEPR report, I think, is important there. But also the other thing was the patient experience of being in observation way too long and them having to pay more out of pocket, et cetera. And they've since changed how they do what they owe. But anyway, I find it interesting. And now the Medicare Advantage plans want more extended observation stays. So anyway, but Dr. McNair, do you have anything to add?
We often find when CMS seeks to clarify things, they actually muddy the water. So the 2 midnight rule created in 2013 was actually intended to very clearly delineate which cases could be covered under Part A versus Part B. We understand that sometimes patients come in extremis and require a large amount of services. So in 2016, CMS implemented the exceptions to the 2 midnight rule. I think one of the important clinchers among all of this is, as Dr. Fall said, there is clearly written into the documentation the opportunity to use complex medical factors and the physician's judgment to deem when a patient is inpatient appropriate versus observation appropriate. And that has been the muddy water that we find ourselves in, and what has eventually led to the drift where we've seen the MA plans depart, and then the subsequent creation of the 2024 Final Rule 4201, which also is loosely referred to as New to Midnight Rule as well. So here we are in 2013, CMS said, let's make it clear. We're going to establish the Midnight Rule. In 2016, CMS said, let's make it clear. Not all patients have to be in two midnights. Now, here we are again in 2024. Let's make it clear. Medicare Advantage plans are supposed to behave like traditional Medicare. Just as an additional background, I'll say that CMS originally authorized the creation of Medicare Advantage plans to take advantage of some of the financial savings that those Medicare Advantage plans have received. But unfortunately, CMS did not create a pathway for the government to benefit from those savings. Those savings do not transfer in any way, shape, or form back to the government. Further, the criteria that CMS established for rating Medicare Advantage plans and determining when they would get bonuses are more task-oriented rather than truly quality-oriented. So it's, have your diabetics had a hemoglobin A1C in the last 12 months? It's not, what percentage of your patients have a hemoglobin A1C under 7 for the last 12 months? So with the genesis of the MA plans in that two midnight rule, there were some lapses in how that was structured that have brought us where we are today, because CMS unintentionally created a bypass or a way for the MA plans to craft so that they could achieve the savings that they've achieved. So this two midnight rule that was originally established to make everything so much clearer for all of us has gotten us where we are. So we will continue on this journey as CMS 4201 will also have some lapses, which we'll talk about later.
I would add one more thing since Dr. McNair brought up about the bonuses. I completely agree that heretofore, the mechanism for Medicare Advantage plans were basically process goals, you know, like she mentioned, you know, just did you check a hemoglobin A1C? They were not outcome goals. And they were add-ons. The bonuses associated with the quality with MA plans was above what would be traditionally paid by Medicare. For example, the value-based purchasing that is associated with hospitals is a zero-sum game. They're winners and losers. At the lower quartiles in the hospital rankings, they lose that 2%, and then it's distributed to the winners. That is not the case with Medicare Advantage. This is an add-on. So Humana and UHC aren't competing with each other for set of bonus dollars. They all can get bonus dollars.
So question for you both related to CMS now applying the Medicare two midnight rules more aggressively with the Medicare Advantage plans. Do you think they have clarified the gray area or the definitions of OBS versus inpatient? I always think of medical necessity versus a time frame. It still seems very up in the air and not very clear. What are your thoughts on that? Dr. Manera, I'll start with you.
Yeah, so I'll say Kodiak just released a study in the last month or so that measured OBS rates in the last half of 2023 compared to 2024. And the MA plans went from around 18 to 20% OBS in the last half of 2023 to 14 to 15% in 2024. So we've seen some improvement, but traditional Medicare OBS rates are around 5%. So we're still not there, definitely. We have seen a lot of what I'll call slippage from the payers. Initially in the year, we were getting really interesting comments from payers like, we don't understand it, so we're not changing anything, or that doesn't apply to us. I mean, really off the wall responses. We're no longer getting those, but we're definitely seeing slippage. They're creating that opportunity, right? Just as they did under the original two midnight rule. We see a lot of them hanging in their hats on criteria. When the CMS memo from February 6th very clearly states the patient's individual circumstances must be considered against the permissible applicable coverage criteria, algorithms or artificial intelligence alone cannot be used. So we see where they're weighing their guidelines and their screening criteria over the true intent of the two midnight rule. So that's a long way to say, no, it's not all clear now.
Okay. And so, Dr. Fall, I want you to add to that and tell us what are the main differences between how the Medicare to Midnight Rule applies to traditional Medicare versus Medicare Advantage plans.
Well, my short answer is there should be really no difference except the presumption, which I'll clarify in just a moment. In the 4201F that Dr. Munier has already mentioned, CMS was very explicit in trying to remove some of this gray. And then in the memo that she also referenced, they walked through some very specific scenarios in that fax document that I recommend everyone look at, because it's kind of a roadmap, a Bible, if you will, of what really the Medicare Advantage plan should be held to. Now, I'm not saying there's teeth in that, and we can talk about how you can address that the best way you can. But CMS said that, and they've always said this, but that Medicare Advantage plans have to pay for what traditional Medicare would pay for. And they also added, there's a very specific language in there that says, for example, this includes payment criteria for patients that meet the two midnight rule. So they specifically talk about the two midnight rule and reference the Federal Register 412.3. They also reference the inpatient only list. They also reference the post-acute stuff, SNF, IRFs, and LTACs, that, you know, because we've seen a lot of denials in that space as well. So they specifically refer to the Federal Register that the same criteria that fee-for-service Medicare uses in all those instances, Medicare Advantage plans also have to. And if there's local coverage determinations that are in the area that they cover, they also have to follow those. In our area, for example, there's a local coverage determination that expressly defines what observation is. It is usually not more than 24 hours, should never exceed 48 hours. OB should not be used as a substitution for necessary inpatient care. So there are really specific things that Medicare tried to clear up, but to Dr. McNair's point, it really isn't happening. The only thing that I would say the distinction is the two midnight presumption. If you look at, there's a document called the BFCCQIO Two Midnight Claim Review Guide that was 2016, again, to what Dr. McNair had mentioned. And the very first step is what's called the presumption. After an inpatient order, did the patient stay two midnights? That is presumed, that is a directive by CMS to the MACs, basically, that if a patient passed two midnights after an inpatient order, that claim is presumed to be payable for Part A, and you don't need to necessarily review that claim. What CMS said in 4201F is that the Medicare Advantage plans do not have to follow the presumption. But they said specifically they have to follow the two-midnight benchmark, which is everything else. The two-midnight presumption is a directive on how to review claims. So Medicare Advantage plans can review claims any way they want. They don't have to do it by, if it's two midnights, we won't look at it. They can still look at that. They can do retrospective, prospective, concurrent review. They can do whatever they want, but they still are supposed to follow the two-midnight. And it seems to me, you know, they may even have documents that say exactly what CMS says. But I think in my even discussions with some of the leadership, the medical directors and CMOs, they seem to conflate presumption with the benchmark and that they don't have to follow the benchmark, which is not what CMS said.
Great commentary so far. Now that we have a good understanding of what's out there, the rules and the regs and some of the things we're seeing, I want to get into challenges and concerns that hospitals are seeing with the implementation of this ruling with the Medicare Advantage plans, what kind of payer behavior you're seeing, and what can we do about it, and is there any enforcement that we can use with CMS? So I'll start with you, Dr. McNair. What challenges and concerns are you seeing from the Medicare Advantage plans since this 4201 ruling or legislation that came out?
Yeah, I would say that you can bucket the two largest ways I see payers introduce slippage or creatively walk around CMS 4201. One is they are being an armchair quarterback. They use progress notes to refute an assertion by the attending physician that a patient should stay two midnights. That is happening. So progress notes are more important than ever. Also, that is really beyond any sort of clinical judgment that a payer should be making. They're not practicing. They should not be asserting in any way, shape, or form that a clinician's conclusion is incorrect. The other way I mentioned is we're seeing them really, really grasp clinical guidelines over the concept of the two midnight benchmark. So they will say, yes, but the patient didn't meet on day two. They didn't meet on day three. They didn't meet on day four. They didn't meet on day five. And we're ending up with 5 to 7 day stays where a patient was receiving appropriate in-hospital care. But because they couldn't check a single guideline off, they're not approving inpatient. All of the literature from CMS, all of the regulations are very clear that there is also some complex medical judgment in there. So guidelines aren't Bibles. They are directionally appropriate, but they are not complete. And we're seeing the payers really latch onto the concept of guidelines. Now, as far as what we can do as an industry to address this, is the first thing that we do, and I recommend everybody do, is collect data. We call these egregious cases internally. We call them CMS 4201 violations. We document every one. CMS has, over the course of this year, changed the way that you can report CMS 4201 violations. They created a central inbox. I highly recommend that every facility track and trend by payer and that you are reporting this to the CMS regional offices. You do have to follow those cases all the way through the appeals process before you report. Additionally, tracking and treating allows facilities to bring up these cases at JOCs with their payers. If you're not having JOCs with your highest volume payers, if you're not showing up reporting very specific 4201 violations, you are denying yourself an avenue to address these with the payers. We have seen some incremental movement with payers when we take this approach. So those are my recommendations.
Okay, Dr. Fall?
Yeah, I agree with that. We do meet. I've met with the, you know, even CMOs at some of our organizations and gone over every one of our 4201 violations that, you know, from our point of view. And I will say that they do follow the inpatient only list. You know, I told you there was three components. You know, there's the 2 minute expectation, the benchmark, there's the inpatient only list and the case by case exceptions. They are all following the inpatient only list, which they didn't used to do. Some of them did, but many of them did not. So that's good. But, you know, we can have these discussions and just get nowhere. As far as the elevation process to CMS, it is cumbersome. It has to be one complaint or one filing at a time. Each one is password protected. You have to document that you know, what did you do and to discuss with the payer to try to remedy it. And then the payer has 30 days to come back to the person who submitted it to try to work it out. And CMS really is just kind of a facilitator. There's no teeth at this point in the process. I do think data is key to try to show them how they may be different from other payers. And I think ultimately, and this may be getting ahead of ourselves, but I think contracting is the way that you really are going to get to the heart of this, because nibbling around the edges, all these other things, just an increased administrative burden. Right? CMS supposedly was going to make this simpler, and it's actually increased our administrative burden. You know, the literature out there is that roughly 25 to 30% of healthcare dollars are waste due to administrative burden being a big part of that. I think we spend $4.3 trillion annually in the U.S. on healthcare. So if that number is correct, that 25 to 30% is waste, that's over $1 trillion. And, you know, we talked about during the pandemic of moral injury, which is where a clinician knows the right thing to do and can't do it. Either they didn't have PPE, they didn't have the equipment in some smaller places. You didn't have the strength anymore because you were exhausted. There's moral injury that accumulates over time. And I know some people will think this is, you know, dramatic, but I don't think it is. The administrative burden contributes to the moral injury of clinicians that are at the bedside that say, I don't understand. This patient is sick. Why am I having to do a peer-to-peer on this? Why am I having to fight? Additionally, when it was obvious in their documentation. Now, documentation is key. It really is vital. But we have to have some deference to the bedside clinician and realize that these criteria that Dr. Manera is talking about, though very good, number one, a physician doesn't have to use them. You know, there are screening criteria that are really nurse-level review criteria. And they are based on population data. What the clinician is seeing is an individual patient, that they're taking all this population data that they've studied and learned and applying it at an individual level. And that part of that is an art. And so we are taking away, you know, because we want to try to be objective, yes, you know, and be evidence-based. All that is true, but there has to be deference to the bedside clinician. And that's what the two-minute rule really is that there's deference to what the clinician is saying. So long answer that there are some techniques I think you can do, but they're difficult. There's no easy solutions.
Okay. So I have a few questions, follow-up questions. Is it always obvious what criteria the Medicare Advantage plan is using to grade that patient's stay? Dr. McNair, I'll start with you.
So one of the provisions of 4201 is that they have to provide that information. They have to specify what guidelines they're using and why this patient doesn't meet for inpatient. So we're delighted that CMS 4201 added clarity in that regard. But generally speaking, in working with payers, yes, most facilities understand which set of guidelines a particular payer is using. It's actually considered a violation of CMS regulation if a payer refuses to say exactly why it doesn't meet for inpatient. But again, that almost reinforces the idea of use your guidelines and stick to your guidelines instead of the complex medical factors. So there's a perpetual spin there where, you know, the spirit is that guidelines aren't everything, but then we want the payer to be very clear about what guidelines they're using and why it didn't meet. So again, this is a government program and there's some swirl.
So I agree. And then, so Dr. Fall, I'm going to go back to you for a second. So physicians are ultimately responsible for that patient status order and for documenting that medical necessity. I agree, physicians are thinking more clinically and how to take care of the patient. They do not get trained or understand the payer regulations. They don't typically see that stuff. But we have a question from our audience. What are the best practices for a physician documenting medical necessity of an inpatient admission to comply with the two-midnight rule? So thinking about it is their responsibility, but they're clinical. Like, how do you get them to understand the documentation?
Well, I think that if you're, the short answer is you're documenting what you're planning to do. You have your diagnosis and then what you're planning to do with each of those things. And you've incorporated, you know, the signs and symptoms throughout your H&P or your admitting document. That's what you have to, you know, we used to say think in ink when we wrote everything down. Now that we have EMRs, you have to write everything out or type everything out. And it has to be for that specific patient. So you can't use a smart phrase that is generic for every heart failure patient. You might use that to get you started, but then you have to speak why this patient's BNP is elevated. This patient has bibasal or has crackles halfway up. This patient's requiring supplemental oxygen. This patient's going to require IV diuretics at least twice a day. This patient's going to have to be on telemetry and in the ICU. So you have to be specific. And those things that I just rattled off very easily would be something that you would expect to have a two-minute expectation. So if you are saying when you put that inpatient order in, intrinsically, that means that you think the patient's going to be there two midnights. So why do you think that? That's what you should be writing. And there are certainly support systems that can be used, you know, like evidence care that can help with that. But to Dr. McNair's point, and this is so important, is that CMS does not defer to criteria. We should not defer to criteria, i.e. MCG or interqual. And CMS said that they don't defer to those things. And one specific example that I will say that I think is really important is that if a patient comes in and they meet OBS level care that first midnight based on interqual or MCG, and they stay another midnight, again, this is past that inpatient order, the physician thought they were going to stay two midnights, and that still is only observation level criteria per one of the guidelines. That's an inpatient admission per CMS. And that is really important because the payers will say, well, that patient never met for inpatient per their guidelines, but they spent two midnights receiving necessary hospital services. That should be an inpatient admission. So that is really difficult to have a conversation with the payers because they just have a hard time going there.
Dr. McNair, do you want to add anything to that before I ask a different question?
That was so well illustrated, but I just do want to add a couple of points. When I'm teaching documentation to frontline clinicians, as we move along in our careers, there is an inner monologue that we're executing that we're not even aware of it. That's what we have to get out on the paper for it. So I follow up on the CHF patient the next day. I'm thinking in my head, well, he's still got my basilar crackles. They are a little bit better, but I'm not comfortable letting him go because I'm pretty sure he bounced back. We're making all of that assessment in our head and we're not writing it out. So I recommend that we write it out loud. The other thing is every day in every note, say why this patient can't go home yet. Say what you're looking for and say what the risk of discharge is in every single progress note. Another area where I find tremendous payers really taking advantage of something is contradictions in our notes. For instance, if we have somebody who is not taking much by mouth, but we have them a diet ordered, maybe they're only taking 20% of it, and we don't comment on that. And listen, I've been on the payer side. I'm going to admit to you right now, I've been on the dark side. Well, if they're not eating or they're not supposed to eat, why is a diet written for? Or we admitted somebody for hypoxic respiratory failure and they're on maybe 3 liters of oxygen and they're at 90%. Well, that's not hypoxic by our criteria. Just explain that. Explain that in your documentation. Yeah, I know this patient's on 3 liters with a SAT of 90%, but it would be too dangerous for us to remove the supplemental oxygen and ask this patient to run down the hallway so I can capture a low saturation. But simply adding that additional explanation of contradictions in the chart can be super helpful. Those are just some concrete, though exactly what Dr. Fall said, if it's observation appropriate, we're delivering care and it's beyond 2 midnights. It's inpatient appropriate, but some of these documentation tweaks can reduce that administrative burden by spelling that out on the chart.
Great tips. So I have another question. So you touched on the inpatient only list, and there's a question that it's interesting you find that the Medicare Advantage plans are following the inpatient only list. This facility is not seeing that. During the pre-cert, the payer says that it is an outpatient procedure, and then post-admit, when they push for inpatient, they say you're denied because you don't have an inpatient pre-cert. So are you seeing any of those games with the inpatient-only list?
No, we've seen really good compliance with the inpatient-only list because it's so black and white. It is the single area where there is clear black and white. I'm surprised, and I definitely would escalate that. I would sit down in a JOC, get your contracting team, and have a conversation because that is exceeding. We see inappropriate behavior all the time, but come on, it is a black and white list.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
I agree with that. That's the one thing that... You know, a little glimmer, a little ray of hope is that the inpatient only list has been adopted pretty easily. I know that there are sometimes after the fact, like, so say a CPT has been pre-certed as outpatient, it's an outpatient CPT. There's a surgery and then something intraoperatively happens that this sometimes the physician doesn't even realize that tweak, you know, is now an inpatient, is now become an inpatient only list. An obvious one is, you know, it's something that was closed. Now we had to convert to open because we nicked the bow or something. Well, you didn't know that was going to happen. You didn't get an auth for that. And so sometimes payers will play that game. It's like, well, you didn't auth, you know, the inpatient CPT. Well, yes, because we didn't plan on that happening. So that is really just gamesmanship. And that should be elevated because that's just inappropriate.
So you both have touched a little bit on contracting, and Jackie, you had mentioned that payers are starting to use more AI in claims reviews. So have either of you used contracting to hold the payers accountable, whether it be receiving 100% of fee-for-service rates, timely payments, limiting scope of post-payment reviews, but also with AI, if they're using AI to deny, can we ask them to be transparent with that and maybe review some of these claims manually before they deny it? What are your thoughts on all of that? And I'll start with you, Dr. Meiner.
Yeah, definitely those things need to be visited with the contracting team. Particularly where AI is supported and used, we need that transparency because the CMS 4201 memo very clearly states they cannot just use AI. They cannot just use AI. So it's really important to have that transparency. I'll say where a contract has already been established, it is challenging to go back and renegotiate that contract. So another potential avenue is always an addendum. You can negotiate an addendum to that contract. It is very challenging to renegotiate an existing contract. Does that mean it's not worth it? No, but you really have to have the facility all on the same side. You can't have half the team saying, well, we can't lose these members, and half the team saying, yes, but the contract is really important for us to renegotiate. So the first step in that is to get everybody within the facility on the same side and prepared to do what it takes to get the payer at the table and willing to negotiate.
Dr. Fall?
Yeah, I think that I would echo all that. You know, if you are in a market where you have some leverage, you know, you're a big hospital, you might be able to renegotiate things, but it's never easy, you know, especially if maybe there's another situation going on. You know, who was it? Rom, who said never let a crisis go to waste. So if there's another contract dispute going on in the area, maybe use that to your advantage. But some things that are theoretically good. I'm not saying that it's always possible, but you know, a lot of times you sign these contracts and within them, there's the ability for the Medicare Advantage plan to unilaterally change things with the way they do the provider manual. You know, and one of those would be AI that I would specifically call out, that they can't unilaterally start using AI to a great degree that affects the way they adjudicate claims. I would put that in there specifically if you could. Also, try to, they're going to kick against it. But if you do have some leverage, that let's get some more granularity around the two-midnight rule and use that BFCCQIO document that, you know, this is what CMS says is a two-minute expectation. You're probably not going to get everything, but if you get a little bit closer to what fee-for-service Medicare is, it'll just make it easier. Because one of the things that is so challenging is the UM staff and the revenue integrity staff. Well, okay, UHC wants to do it this way. Humana wants to do it this way. And it's very difficult to manage all that. So if you could try to get some alignment with that over time. And then one other thing is, if you could try to get, before they do any recoupments, that you are allowed to submit an appeal. A lot of times they just take the money back and you don't even realize it if you're not following. But those are all hard fought, almost pugilistic events to do that. You know, it's more those de novo contracts that you have a little bit easier time.
Agreed.
Yeah. And I would add briefly, Carol, you know, what we're seeing from a strategy landscape is many health systems very much, you know, exactly to your point, Dr. McNair, holding a hard line around this contract. I think there's a lot of opportunity to make contracts shorter, especially in this age of AI, to not be signing multi-year contracts and to be saying we're only going to take a 1 to 2 year contract so that we're able to renegotiate terms if you are starting to, you know, substantially deviate from norms in the market or use, you know, new tools like AI, you can kind of rein that in a lot more easily. I think shorter contracts and also the threat of terms tied to commercial contracts, all of those things can be really helpful in terms of getting a little more leverage, exactly to your point, Dr. Paul.
I am seeing, and maybe you see this, Jackie, in the market, that there are more and more hospitals who are dropping MA plans. So I found that very interesting. I did a talk in Pennsylvania, and a major healthcare system was dropping a few major payers because they were not coming to the table and working with the hospital. But I do have another great question, and it touches on something like related. Think about social admissions to a hospital. And the question is, how do our panelists deal with local practice patterns or hospital operational inefficiencies that causes the care to extend beyond the two midnights, or it is an unsafe discharge and that also extends the two midnights? So maybe they're waiting on PT services or something like that. How are you dealing with those cases who maybe a social admit, or there's a delay in getting an imaging study, or you want the patient to have some PT before they go home, but it's really not inpatient? I'll start with you, Dr. McNair.
Yeah, so that's tough, and it really takes a multidisciplinary approach. So I recommend that all facilities have a multidisciplinary team that helps to deal with those difficult discharges. Sometimes you may even need to get other parties involved. I was reading a case the other day where there's a patient that needs to be repatriated to Mexico, and there's nobody willing to pay for it. But even in simple delays, first of all, I would approach that in contracting. As Jackie said, do a short length contract. You can talk to your payer about being paid for a lower rate for delays in transition, as many of those are caused by the payer, right? We're waiting on a payer to give us approval. If they're going to do that, if they're going to play that game, then they need to pay. Then also, like I said, a multidisciplinary approach, have community members, community resources in mind. I'll say I don't often see people take advantage of payer resources related to that. When I was on the payer side, I worked with a care management team. We had a robust care management team, and providers did not take advantage of that. Health systems did not take advantage of the fact that we had care managers and social workers. We wanted the facility to get the patients to the next level of care as quickly as possible. That's a resource I see tremendously underutilized. Definitely, we need to take advantage of every way a payer is going to help us. And then this is about data too. This is about tracking and trending. Who are your biggest offending payers who are causing these delays? What are your biggest reasons for contributing to these delays? And start developing programs where you can flood those particular issues with resources. Dr. Small?
I agree with all that. I think that, you know, if a patient is stayed one midnight and they're basically ready to go, and then for family convenience, the patient then extends to a second midnight, you know, through our UM reviews, we would not bill that. Our secondary physician review would say that that was a convenience admission that pushed past two midnights. We would not expect a Part A reimbursement, an inpatient reimbursement for that. So your UM procedures have to be tight on those things. But in converse to Dr. McNair's point, when we have a patient who's needs to go to a SNF, and because they have a narrow network or because they're delaying the authorization, now we're 2 or 3 days past when the patient could have been discharged. We should be getting a per diem SNF rate for that. You know, they want to say, we're paying you a DRG rate. And if we've not hit stop loss, you know, or hit an outlier status where they start have to pay percentage of charges, that's when it gets their attention. They'll work very quickly. But if they don't have to pay percentage of charges and they're writing out a DRG, they're not as quick to act. So I think that's another thing that should be mentioned again for contracting, is that you have something in place where they're paying, there's still money that they have to pay. And that makes them much more apt to respond. But the overarching principle, Carol, is that if it's, because CMS says this, if it's for convenience, you know,
they will not cover it.
We're not going to cover it. And it's not fair. You know, there are cases that the way we particularly do UM is that if a patient stays, say that there was a 2-minute expectation, but there wasn't anything unexpected that happened and it's a 0 midnight stay. Well, CMS says that, you know, there's almost nothing that they're going to pay for a 0 midnight stay unless it's an inpatient only. So we try to do our due diligence. The payers aren't always wrong, but you know, we have to do our part too. But some of this seems really egregious and adds to that accumulating moral injury.
Yes. So we're getting close on time, but I just want to add a little bit on the social admits. There is a responsibility of hospitals to take care of the population in their area as well. So that you may have social admits and
for
you
sure.
Just have to eat those. But if there's internal efficiencies that you can work on, like the MRI and PT and like putting those patients first who have a discharge order, there are certain things that you can do internally with your case management, UR teams, imaging. I would most definitely work on that. We have one more question, and then I'm going to ask a short question on the Chevron ruling. So we have another question around related to what you were talking about, Dr. McNair, about documentation. Do any standard attestation type statements carry weight in the denial review process? Or is it much more beneficial to have very specific clarifications to the documentation related to the unique patient issue?
So I'll say no. any sort of scripted attestation means nothing. And you know why? Because as doctors, we check boxes, and you're going to check that box on a case for which it's not appropriate. So I'll tell you, from the payer side, I don't care if you've signed an attestation. I need to see the medical necessity. Also, from this side, from your defense side, I need to see the medical necessity in your documentation. The answer is no. An attestation alone is never going to be sufficient to defend your stay.
And I've also seen some statements like, I don't want to send my patient home because of the potential for adverse events, like a standard statement. Does that work either?
No, it has to be specific to the patient.
Okay. All right.
Everything has to be individualized. You can use a smart phrase to get you started, but then you have to put some meat on those bones because it just doesn't matter.
Okay. So I'm going to ask a quick question on Chevron, then we'll wrap up. But how do you anticipate the Chevron ruling and how it may affect medical necessity and determination and appeals in the future? I know we haven't really seen a whole lot, but I'm going to start with you, Dr. Fall, on that one.
So as everyone knows, the Loper Bright case earlier this year, I think maybe June, changed 40 years of law regarding Chevron deference, which was that if the statute, the regulation wasn't clear, then the individual, like CMS, for example, the individual agency can then provide some interpretation of that, and that was given deference. So that when a court case came up, that the judiciary had to give deference to the agency's interpretation, and that is gone now. So I don't know. I don't have a crystal ball or a magic eight ball or anything. I think it's going to be a case by case basis. There was a case that came up before the Second Circuit here just recently, and the ruling was in deference to the deference. So they didn't overrule the Chevron's what the agency had already done as far as the interpretation of the regulation. So I think it's going to be political in some cases. I do have some concern that even though, of course, judges and the judiciary are very accomplished people, there are sometimes such nitty-gritty nuances to these things that stuff that we have thought was codified and was written in stone may change all of our world one day. So we have to be ready to be facile to respond. But I don't know how that's going to happen. I think it could be capricious or it could be very methodical. I would hope that 40 years, even though the Supreme Court changed, that the judiciary would be very circumspect when they are looking at these cases. But I can't predict.
Okay, Dr. McNair, just quick. Anything?
I totally agree with Dr. Fall. We'll see.
Okay. Well, I want, that's all the time we have today, but I want to thank Dr. McNair, Dr. Fall, and Jackie. You guys have been wonderful, and thank you for taking the time to share your perspectives and all your knowledge. And this is everyone clapping, saying thank you so much. And thank you all who have joined us live today, and have a great rest of your day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Better Care Podcast. To ensure you never miss an episode, we encourage you to subscribe to the podcast on your preferred platform. Additionally, your ratings and reviews are invaluable in helping us reach a wider audience. Please consider leaving a review, and if you do, email us a screenshot at marketing@evidence.care, and we'll send you a thank you gift. For access to exclusive content and further healthcare insights created by Evidence Care, please visit evidence.care/bettercarepodcast and subscribe to our email list. We appreciate your support and look forward to connecting soon.